Joseph Farrell, welcome to Dreamland.
Hey, Whitley, thanks for having me back.
Oh, it's so exciting always to have you back. And today we're going to be dealing with two enormously important and lovely books, Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men by Joseph. The Grit of the Gods, written by Joseph and his friend Scott D. DeHart. Both of these books are intimately connected, Joseph, but on Dreamland we're going to talk mostly about Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men. And then in the subscriber area, we're going to get into the Grid of the Gods. What is it? What can we actually do now to make it work for us and enable us to increase our understanding of this world? This world is not what it seems, is it, Joseph?
No, it isn't, Whitley, and that's partly the reason I'm trying to write these books, and my co-author and I are busily writing another that just got accepted for publication. So, yeah, it's a very, very complex picture, and I think, you know, the key to it lies in part in our past. I really do, and I take a great deal of care to outline in my books the texts that I think that outline our past, and in Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men, I attempt to correlate that with some of the findings of modern genetics, and it's really kind of an eerie
kind of
parallel.
Eerie is right. Go ahead.
Well, one of the things that I've talked about in the past is the idea that we might be genetically engineered. Well, it so happens, and I get into this in Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men, that an Oxford geneticist by the name of Brian Sykes, and if people don't know that name, they should acquaint themselves with it, because Dr. Sykes has published a couple of books. One is called The Seven Daughters of Eve, and he gets into the clan mothers of the European population. And
let's talk about that's about midway through
right.
Genes, Genes, Giants, Monsters, and but explain who the clan mothers are.
Well, the clan mothers are the mitochondrial groupings, mitochondrial DNA haplogroups that divide the European population roughly into seven clans. Europeans come from apparently seven clan mothers, and ultimately, of course, all human beings come from a common mother, at least as far as modern genetics is concerned.
Yes. Now, these seven clan mothers were actual people.
Oh, yes, absolutely, absolutely. There's a fair amount of evidence that all Europeans are descended from basically only seven women. And this I find very interesting because I correlate the data that we come from a common mother to ancient texts and to the fact that you have these seven clan mothers in Europe, and apparently if you correlate that to the ancient texts, the texts make it clear that we come from one donor father that is, so to speak, the Anunnaki or the gods, or I like to simply call them the genetic cousins, and 14 human females. If you trace Dr. Sykes' work, there is an interesting correlation because there, apparently in genetics, is the idea that we come from approximately 13, and in the text, it's 14 clan mothers. So, you know,
interesting. Now, this father, mm-hmm. Who exactly was this? Was this also a single individual?
Well, in the text, yes, it is. It's very interesting. I don't get into this aspect of it in Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men, but the texts indicate that the male was the donor as far as the texts were concerned from the so-called gods, and then the human part of modern humanity came from some sort of donor mothers. And I find that very, very interesting, particularly with regard to the fact that apparently, all the races of humanity, with the exception of Africans, have some strong admixture of Neanderthal DNA. This is something that genetics has just come out with recently. So, you know, I think our origins, Whitley, are going to be increasingly scrutinized by geneticists. And what bothers me, and I set out to write Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men with the idea that perhaps the Genome Project was looking for confirmation of this ancient scenario. And I found a certain amount of correlation between the two, but wasn't able to find any hard and fast evidence that this was indeed the case. But I think the case that I outlined there is at least circumstantially suggestive that, that this may be what they're looking for.
Yeah, or, you know, you have to wonder if they find something they don't want to find and don't want to see, what then happens?
Well, I think, Whitley, that's really the important question here. If they found proof of that, or if they found at least enough evidence to suggest the possibility of it, would they release it? And my guess is, at the moment, they probably wouldn't, because I think that's all tied into, you know, the subject of extraterrestrials, UFOs, and disclosure. And thus far, governments, as you well know, have proven to be less than forthcoming.
Yeah, and you have to wonder why it is that these things that apparently happened in the deep, deep past in what in the book in Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men you refer to as the wall of silence between the megalithic age and the earliest civilization, and we'll get into that a little bit more in a moment. But, you know, if it is no longer relevant, if it's now all part of the past, why is the research so difficult to do, and why is so much apparently being hidden?
Well, that's the other thing I ran into, Whitley, and that, again, I think that's tied into this whole question as to whether or not they are really looking for these things. My gut tells me that they probably are, but in the process of researching the book, I ran into so many articles that appeared to be obfuscation. There was the whole episode with the geneticist Chang in Canada that allegedly said that we found proof, genetic proof, that we're descended from extraterrestrials, and then there's a suggestive comment to that effect by an Australian geneticist. But beyond that, it's very, very difficult to find anything.
But tell us a little bit more about this paper that you're referring to now.
Well, I forget the man's name in Australia, but he did come out and suggest that human junk DNA, which is mostly found in the male Y chromosome, which is very, very interesting. We'll get back to that in a moment, is possibly extraterrestrial in nature. They don't really know why it's there. They're carefully and slowly unpacking what they think it's for. But this junk DNA does not appear to come from anywhere normal. In other words, the current evolutionary suggestion is it simply jumped species from animals and so on, rodents particularly, into humanity. But the Australian geneticist came out and said that it's possible that this may be some sort of marker of extraterrestrial origins. Well, if that's the case, I find that very interesting, Whitley, because, again, that would correlate to the ancient texts from Mesopotamia, which state that the god part, or as I like to call them, the genetic cousins, came from the male donor. And it's precisely in the Y chromosome of the male that you find most of this junk DNA. You know, and they're being rather cautious about talking about the paternity of the human species, because that can only be traced through males, through the Y chromosome, whereas our maternity can be traced through mitochondrial DNA, which all of us carry.
Early on in the show, you mentioned the seven women who, at various times over a long period of megalithic history, were impregnated.
Right.
Now, we just touched on who impregnated them, but aren't there legends that I believe it was the Anunnaki who forcibly impregnated human women?
Well, yes, that's one component of this story. In the Mesopotamian text, it's very clear that one male donor was responsible for contributing the so-called divine part to the creation of the human species. What I find very interesting, Whitley, is that I mentioned in Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men, you find similar legends from Mesoamerica of giants that fought humanity. And the strong suggestion is made, just as it is in the biblical text, that they were also involved in sexual practices that, for some reason, were offensive to the gods, all right?
Let me stop us here. Mm-hmm. I think sexual practices that were offensive to the gods is an excellent place to pause.
Sure.
Take a breath. We'll be right back.
Okay.
This is Whitley Strieber. We're talking to Joseph Farrell, one of Dreamland's all-time most popular guests, and you can certainly hear why listening to this interview today. His books, Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men. And for subscribers, we're going to be talking about The Grid of the Gods, the aftermath of the cosmic war, and the physics of the pyramid peoples. What are these mysterious pyramids that are all over the earth? Why are they placed where they are? And what can we do to empower ourselves in relation to the energies that are present still from a lost science in this enormous lost scientific instrument on earth? Can we turn it on again? Now, before we left the air, we were talking about strange sexual practices and a sense of some kind of violent and perverse thing that was going on in the distant past that perhaps involved the genetic evolution and changes to the human species. Joseph, I don't know quite what exactly to ask you except to just continue where we were.
Well, the oddest thing, Whitley, that I find in dealing with all of these problems is you find the odd presence within Mesoamerican literature of the notion that humanity is somehow genetically engineered. I mean, this is very clear from the various texts. And you find...
Can you give us an example?
Yeah, you have things like the Lugalay, the Atrahasis epic, and other texts that I discuss in The Cosmic War, where it's very clear that you had some genetic cousin of the human species coming to this planet and engineering humanity by a mixture with themselves. In other words, modern humanity, from the standpoint of the ancient texts, is kind of a hybrid creature. What interested me in researching Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men was when you go to Mesoamerica, you find the exact same notion. You have the idea of the interference of some species with humanity, and it's in the process of doing that, it is displeasing the gods, and so the gods wipe out the species, which in the Mesoamerican case and in the North American Indians case are a bunch of giants. So you have all of this presence.
Who would the gods be in that case?
Well, in Mesoamerica's case, it's going to be things, you know, Kukulcan, Quetzalcoatl, and the other tribal gods. In the case of Mesopotamia, it's going to be, you know, the typical Mesopotamian pantheon, Marduk, and so on and so forth. But you have the same notion present. And what's really interesting to me is, again, you have this idea that the divine side is coming from the male and the human side is coming from these female donors. And again, the numbers, what struck me most interestingly is apparently from the text they selected, the Mesopotamian text, they selected, I think it was 13, if my memory serves me correctly, 13 human donor mothers.
Yes, that's right. It was 13.
And in the case of modern genetic research, it appears that ultimately there were 14 original clan mothers to all of humanity after the original mitochondrial Eve, which I think is very, very interesting. It's almost too close for comfort.
It is, because the old texts are talking about a number that's extremely close to the actual number.
Yes, exactly, exactly. So, you know, I think, again, we're looking at the possibility.
Let me just stop a minute and explain, folks, exactly what this means. What this means is this. The old Mesopotamian texts are saying that these beings, these giants, chose 13 women to cohabitate with, and out of these women came the human species. Modern genetic science is telling us there were 14 such women, and that correspondence. Those two numbers are too close, as Joseph says, for comfort. It really suggests there may be something in this, as impossible as it may seem, but that impossibility is only because of what we've been taught. But go ahead now, Joseph. I just wanted to clarify that for our listeners.
Well, it's that possibility precisely, Whitley, that makes me suspect that at least at some levels of the Genome Project, there may be people involved trying to look for the genetic confirmation of some of these ancient texts, and that's why I mentioned that geneticist from Australia, and I wish to goodness I could remember what his name was. But this whole idea that somehow, if that's the case, then we've got to look at junk DNA, and of course, if we're looking at junk DNA, then we're looking at yet another corroboration of the ancient texts, because again, it's the male donor that sired the so-called divine side of humanity, and it's junk DNA precisely that is the most, percentage-wise, is the predominant composition of junk DNA. In other words, in the Y chromosome that the male carries. So in other words, I think the possibility is strong, although there's no evidence of this as yet, that this is what the Genome Project was in part set up to look for.
Well, Professor Sam Chang of the Human Genome Project said that he speculated that perhaps junk DNA was created by some kind of extraterrestrial programmer.
Right.
He said, our hypothesis is that a higher extraterrestrial life form was engaged in creating new life and planting it on various planets. Earth is just one of them. Now, that is a huge statement coming from someone from the Human Genome Project.
It is, and the problem there is when he came out and said that, it stirred up a little bit of a controversy on the Internet.
Oh, yeah.
And then, lo and behold, Whitley, the other problem was, apparently, people tried to verify that there was a Sam Chang involved in the Genome Project, and they were unable to do so.
So it could be a fake.
It could either be a fake, or it could be a story that was leaked precipitously and without authorization, and then they scrambled to cover it up.
Wow. Yeah, so we're left with a mystery there then.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, you can't ever know for sure what those things are. And unfortunately, the Internet being the Internet, my own thoughts would come down on the side of a hoax, because I live with Internet hoaxes every day of my life.
Yeah,
we probably get 20 hoax UFO videos a day from around the world, and each one by some moron who thinks he's created the best thing since sliced bread. It's hilarious. I mean, they'd never stop.
Yeah.
But so it could very well be a hoax. On the other hand, hoax or not, there's something here.
Yes.
In that the numbers are just too close.
Absolutely. Absolutely. They are too close for comfort. In my opinion, it's not simply a coincidence, Whitley. It's confirmation, in a certain sense, of what the ancient texts are saying.
Now let's get into, Joseph, the fracturing of our knowledge.
Right.
You have had as a theme in much of your work, really, and certainly in both of these books, the idea that once there was knowing.
Right.
Now there is belief and confusion.
Right.
Something broke. What broke, Joseph?
Well, that's an excellent question, Whitley. And in fact, it forms, as you know, a major theme in Grid of the Gods. And again, it's going to be a major theme in the book that my co-author and I are writing now.
Do you have a title yet?
Yeah, I do, but I can't release it yet until I get the book in the publisher's hand.
Oh, I know how that works, because as soon as you do that, 16 e-books will appear on the Internet with the same title.
Exactly. The what you're referring to is what I like to call the Tower of Babel moment of history. And actually, I borrow that phrase from, believe it or not, Leonard Bernstein in a series of lectures that he gave at Harvard University back in 1973. But I think what we are looking at, if you look at all the lore and legend from around the world, there is this idea that at some point humanity's unity was fractured deliberately because it was a threat to God or the gods in some form or fashion. And the way that various legends and traditions from around the world deal with this is very interesting. Of course, in the biblical version, you have the scrambling or the confounding of human language and the creation of several languages so that you split humanity's communication up and fragment his knowledge thereby. In the case of the Mayans, you have the fragmentation of mankind sexually from a kind of a primordial androgyny. This whole idea, in other words, is that humanity was fractured at some very, very basic level, and that in turn led to a fragmentation of knowledge. And I think in response to that, I think that you had ancient societies setting up, and I deal with this quite a bit in Grid of the Gods, but to some extent also in Genius, Giants, Monsters, and Men. I think in response to this, you had somebody attempting to set up or preserve that fragmented knowledge in the form of kind of hidden elites, which in ancient times would manifest themselves in the mystery schools and the various priesthoods that perpetuated human knowledge. So I think we're dealing with something very, very profound that's intimately related to various legends of what I call the Tower of Babel moment of history or the fall of man, what have you.
The fall of man, and here we are. The ship of human society is in stormy waters, and we're terribly, terribly confused.
Yes.
When we get back, we're going to begin to explore some of the incredibly fascinating actual physical evidence of this being quite, quite real. We'll be right back. We're back with Joseph Farrell. His books, Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men, and The Grid of the Gods, his website, GizaDeathStar.com. That's GizaDeathStar.com. You can go there. You can find out more about this fascinating man's fascinating work. Joseph, by the way, is a scholar whose credentials include a Doctor of Philosophy from the University of Oxford in England, no less. He is an expert in fields such as Nazi Germany, sacred literature, physics, finance, the Giza pyramids, and music theory. What a mind. I mean, Joseph, I just have to be blatantly amazed at what you are as a human being. I know you well after all of these years of reading your work and interviewing, and I just have to say, what the most unusual thing is, you've taken a completely different path from most scholars of your stature in this world. Most completely different.
Well, thank you, Whitley. It was kind of a lifelong ambition. So I kind of got fed up with academic paradigms because it was very clear to me that they simply weren't addressing some of these issues.
No, they weren't. They're not. The academic paradigm, if I can outline it, is this: we evolved from an offshoot of the branch of apes, of primates, up through the various different levels that we have found evidence for, physical evidence for, until we reached the point where we were at the Neanderthal Homo sapiens boundary, Cro-Magnon boundary, where this new version, the Cro-Magnons, burst on the scene and more or less began to focus the human mind on the world around it in a new way.
Right.
Now, there's something missing from this picture, I believe. And let's talk about some of the physical evidence, the giants and so forth, that form such a fascinating, wonderful part of genes, giants, monsters, and men.
Well, some of the physical evidence, I actually begin the book with what to me is probably the most unusual bit of physical evidence, and that is the depiction of a chimerical creature on the Ishtar Gate of Babylon that was unearthed by a German archaeologist by the name of Professor Robert Koldewey. And this creature is called the Sirish in Babylonian literature. But it's just bizarre. There's no other word for it. It's just bizarre. It has a kind of like a scorpion-like tail. It has hind feet like a bird, front feet like some sort of feline. It's either got a scaled or feathered body. And then it has the head of a serpent of some sort, okay? But the problem for Professor Koldewey, and he actually wrote about it, you know, he dared to write his thesis, which was that this creature is depicted on the Ishtar Gate between two other very real creatures. In other words, the context here is of a real creature. And the other problem, Whitley, is that he noticed that within Babylonian art, the depiction of this creature did not vary over time. It was something, in other words, that he thought the Babylonians actually saw. And he attempted to explain it in terms of reference to the Iguanodon, an extinct dinosaur by that time. But the problem there, and he even went so far as to admit this, the problem there was the Iguanodons were long extinct in Babylonian times, and yet they're depicting a living creature. And on top of this, there's no known fossils of Iguanodons in Mesopotamia at the time. So he finally came to the conclusion that this was a real creature, a living creature, that the Babylonian priests actually had kept around and fed for a while. And he even couples it to the monster in the apocryphal book of Daniel, Bell and the Dragon as being possibly the basis for that. So you have a little bit of evidence there that these ancient texts that speak of chimerical creatures were in fact talking about something that they actually saw. And the other thing that you mentioned is giants, and this is where it gets very, very interesting because, of course, there's tales from all over the world of giant skeletons, of what appear to be giant human beings. There are certainly tales of the early Spanish explorers arriving in the Americas and encountering Indians of very, very tall stature, you know, sometimes exceeding 7 feet. There are classical references in Herodotus to giants being buried in sarcophagi that would appear to be some 16 feet tall.
Yeah.
Either we have to write these things off as ancient science fiction run amok, but the problem is, again, the context is that these things are being mentioned in ways and in literature that do not read like they're describing something that they have not seen. So in other words, we're not dealing with fiction, we're dealing with a reality. And when you combine these ancient texts with the fact that we're unearthing these things now, then we're dealing with a suppressed history, in my opinion.
Now, why suppressed? It seems so illogical that it would be, but I have to agree with you. I do think there is something about human history that is carefully suppressed, and I just find it mystifying.
Well, I think it's suppressed for a variety of reasons, Whitley, and one of them is the kind of contextual argument that I make in Cosmic War, and that is these texts also speak of tremendous technologies. So in other words, if you can corroborate the existence on the basis of physical evidence that these tales of chimeras and giants and so on are true, then you also have to open the door and admit the possibility that these ancient technologies were true. And if you admit that, then you start a scramble to find those technologies. And I think that's perhaps one reason that all of these things have been suppressed. The other being, I think that, again, if we take the idea that humanity does come from a kind of genetically engineered past, then there's some component of humanity that is not from this world. And one of the things that I think we have to remember that I talk about in the cosmic war that you and I talked about some years ago, is that it is apparent that this technology only worked in the presence of certain people. In other words, there may be some sort of DNA connection. So we're back to the idea that maybe the Genome Project is not only looking to confirm the existence of this genetic component of humanity that comes from somewhere else, but they may be looking for it in order to activate some of that technology.
Yeah. Wow. To activate it. And there's been rumors that that was part of why we went into Iraq.
Yes, and I'm one of those that believes that that may have been one of the very, very hidden agendas. There's just too much, in my opinion, Whitley, there's too much suspicion surrounding the whole Baghdad Museum looting. I mean, my word. There were some, I think, somewhere between 80 to 100,000 cuneiform tablets that were looted from that museum that have never been returned. And really, no one knows where they went. So I think the looting of the artworks that were subsequently returned to Iraq was possibly a front for whatever it was they were really after, which I think was information, and probably information on those tablets.
I wonder if they got it.
I have my intuition that they probably did, or at least some of what they were looking for. I've been trying to follow that story since the Baghdad Museum looting. The most recent thing that I've been made aware of is that Spain is in possession of some of those tablets.
Spain?
Spain, yes. And don't ask me how it got there, because no one seems to know, but Spain has some 80,000 cuneiform tablets that they are not returning to Iraq for whatever reason.
Now, that's fascinating. Do you have any idea what
is on those tablets?
Yeah.
No, this is the other thing, Whitley, that's very, very curious. I've even blogged about this on my website a couple of times. No one seems to know exactly what the catalog of the missing tablets was. And I find that very interesting because, of course, pardon me, the field catalogs that were being maintained of those digs around Iraq for Saddam Hussein were being maintained by the Germans, who had a great number of archaeologists working for Hussein, digging some of these things up. Well, the field catalogs were being kept by the Germans. And try as I might, I cannot find any information on what those catalogs contained. So in other words, we're left completely and totally in the dark as to what those cuneiform tablets may have comprised.
How extraordinary. And
yes, it is.
Yeah. It's really a little bit frightening.
Yes,
because you have to wonder, you know, who in Spain, of all places? It seems like a country that is long since, I mean, I could understand England or Russia or China, certainly,
right.
The United States, obviously. But Spain is, in a way, more chilling because of the fact that if there is a single country in the world where ancient secret societies still thrive,
oh, yes,
Spain.
Spain, absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, not only ancient secret societies, but Spain was also a locus, particularly during the Franco years, was also a locus for what I've been calling the Nazi International activity.
Yes.
Otto Skorzeny had his headquarters right there in Madrid.
Right there in Madrid, Otto Skorzeny, one of the post World War II, the Skorzeny group,
right,
remained a very active Nazi group. Okay, we've come to the end of this segment. Fortunately, not to the end of Dreamland. We're going to get just right back here after a couple of ads. We'll be right back. We're back with Joseph Farrell. His website, GizaDeathStar.com. That's GizaDeathStar.com. His new books, Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men, a hair raiser, and an even more hair raising book, The Grid of the Gods. We're going to be talking in the subscriber section not only about what is going on and what has happened in the past, but how to make use of this energy now, because it's still here. The ancient machinery was built in stone so it would last. And now, when we need it, a very few of us are going to get to use it. Wow. Joseph, before we left the air, we were beginning to talk about a Nazi connection, and you brush on in Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men, the number 33, and you say maybe it was just a coincidence, the relationship between the number 33, the 33 degrees of masonry, but I wondered when I read that, could you elaborate a little bit about on that, and then we're going to get it more deeply into the Nazi connection here.
Well, 33 is, of course, a number that is sacred, more or less, to Scottish Rite Masonry, the 33rd degree being, of course, the final degree, which is by invitation only. But it's also the number of vertebrae in the spine and so on and so forth. It plays a significant role in sacred geometry. So I'm guessing here, Whitley, that 33 is one of those dot connectors with the world grid, because again, 33 plays a certain role in some of the hyperdimensional physics models that I talk about in Grid of the Gods and so on and so forth. If that's what you're getting
at. Yeah, that is what I'm getting at. Yeah. Exactly. Now, the reason I bring it up is that, of course, in my own personal experience, one of my biggest, closest, most open close encounters came when the visitors emitted 9 knocks onto the roof of the house I lived in, 3 groups of 3.
Mm-hmm.
And that number 3, and that also is when a candidate for the 33rd degree of masonry enters the inner sanctum, he knocks 9 times in 3 groups of 3.
Right.
And so and the number 3, the triad, the visitors come in groups of 3.
Right.
And in my book, The Greys, that's really explained. I mean, it's supposedly a book of fiction, but like all my fiction, that's just supposedly. So it's an integral part of my own life experience as well. Now, it has to do also with the energies of the origins of man and what happened to us and what would happen if somebody like the Nazis, who are still a very much of a living part of human culture, don't ever not believe that. In new generations now, got a hold of this power. Tell us, Joseph.
Oh dear, you know, that's a frightening prospect, and I even get into the fact that in Grid of the Gods, in the second chapter, that the Nazis apparently did build many of their installations on ley lines, on grid points. Even Hitler's headquarters in East Prussia, in Rostenburg, East Prussia, was built on the intersection of 2 ley lines. So apparently, they were cognizant to some extent. We don't know to what extent, because most of that research is either so unavailable or still classified that it's very, very hard to pinpoint what they were up to. But they were up to something. They placed many of their transmitters, their Tesla-like transmitters, on some of these grid points and so on and so forth. I shudder to think, Whitley, if they did get their hands on that kind of knowledge or were attempting to utilize it. You know, it's bad enough that they're doing things like the bell.
You know? Yes.
But if they're doing all of this in conjunction with research on the grid and activating that power system, then yeah, we're in some deep trouble.
We're in for deep trouble, but it may be possible to gain access to the power of the grid in other much more human and productive ways.
Yes.
Let's go on now to the great antiquity of man.
Right.
You know, if you could just give us a few examples from the book, from Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men, of the apparent great antiquity, at least of someone's presence on Earth, who had, to say the least, a significant amount of technological skill.
Well, one of the things I do in Genes, Giants, Whitley, is I try and mention some of the research of Michael Cremo, Forbidden Archaeology, and then The Hidden History of the Human Race. And there's two things I would point out in particular. One is a metal pipe that was clearly a machined object. It's kind of a rectangular pipe that was found in chalk beds in France that stratigraphy dates to about 60 million years ago. So in other words, you have a clear product of a technology in a geological age layer that would date it to the age of 60 million years ago. So somebody clearly is here with a technology doing something. The other fascinating thing that they mention in their book is a coin that was discovered in Illinois. It's a coin with an inscription that no one's been able to decipher. But the really interesting thing is that this coin appears to have been run through a rolling mill, much like our modern coins do, to establish a uniform thickness, all right? So in other words, it's not a coin that's made by, you know, a hammer and die. It's a coin that's been passed through a rolling mill and actually cut. And the interesting thing about the age of the coin, Whitley, is it's about 240,000 years old if you date it from the stratigraphy that it was found in. And that's an interesting date in itself because that is the date that you find if you read the Mesopotamian kings lists, that you find the so-called Anunnaki arriving on planet Earth. It's about 240,000 to 250,000 years ago. So you find all of these very, very odd archaeological corroborations between actual known physical objects and ancient texts. And again, you know, modern academics, we talked in the previous section about the academic paradigm. Well, the academic paradigm isn't even looking at these things. It's not even trying to look seriously at the text and find out if they're true.
Exactly. But why not?
Well, again, I think that they're, to a certain extent, they are just simply blind to it, and to a certain extent, I think they're trying to cover up something as well. Again, the idea that humanity is of great antiquity and that somebody was here with a technology, and the technology was at least as sophisticated as our own.
At least, but I think more.
Oh, I do too.
Much more. And I know, the reason I think more is because of this excellent comment you made that they had knowing, not belief,
right. Not
speculation. They knew for certain
right. Something
about this, this world and the way it works that we do not anymore know. And here we are at some kind of a time of ending. I mean, something is going on. The final judgment is Revelation chapter 20, verse 12. And there's some kind of a weave here. We see the sun is getting really hotting up. Our markets are collapsing. Our world is becoming deranged. The climate is becoming all messed up. And I have to say that there's a lot of restlessness all over the planet.
Yes.
This is some kind of a time of change. It has to be.
Yes, I would agree with that. And I think that it is in part due to the physics. And I think that perhaps what they knew, I talk a great deal, as you know, in Grid of the Gods, about what I'm calling the topological metaphor of the physical medium. And what's interesting to me is if you read these ancient texts, the Vedas, the Egyptian texts, even the Mayan Popol Vuh, is they all, if you read it with the eyes of a mathematician, they're all talking about an initial primordial differentiation into three things. In other words, you have primordial trinities all over the place. And there's your number three again. And I think this is emerging from a profound physics that they knew and were passing down in these mythological texts. Well, if that be the case, then we have to look seriously at their ideas of history being occurring in cycles or ages of different kinds of human consciousness. This is particularly true, as you know, in the Vedic tradition and in the Mayan tradition. I think we're dealing with a consciousness that is reflective of and interfaced with the physical medium. And that in turn leads me to speculate in Grid of the Gods that perhaps one reason they constructed this vast global machine, and that, that effectively is what the grid of the gods is.
It is, yes.
I think one of the reasons that they constructed this vast global machine was precisely somehow, although we don't know exactly how, was both to manipulate the physical medium and in turn manipulate human consciousness. So, yeah, I think you're exactly right. I think that they knew something. This was not a matter of faith for them. This was a matter of formally explicit knowledge.
We're going to find out in the subscriber area, who were they and what did they know? And I'm going to end Dreamland and begin the next conversation with this quote. The monuments, these monuments, capacitors to the ley lines, are multi-purpose and they function on many levels. That's a note from Carl P. Monk from his book, Whispers from Time, the Pyramid Bible, quoted in Joseph's book, The Grid of the Gods. Now, we come to the end of Dreamland together, and we're going to go on more deeply for those who are really committed to learning something about this in the subscriber area in order to find out what we can do to make this grid work for us and come alive for us right now. Thank you very much for listening to Dreamland. The reason I've reserved the actionable part of this for the subscriber section is that our subscribers are people who have paid for something. They have said to themselves, this is so important to me. I know things are changing, and I know that I want to do something about it in my own life, and I am willing to pay for that privilege. When I was in the Gurdjieff Foundation, I learned that when we're willing to pay for something the way we've lived in our society, it's more important to us. We are suddenly no longer passive about it. We are active, committed, and that's what it's about. So that's why the actionable part of it, how to use this grid, is going to be there, because I know that the people there who go there will listen, they will take notes, and in the end, they will go and do what they need to do for their souls, because this is where we are right now. It's becoming extremely clear. We definitely do need to take action on our own behalf. In any case, this has been Dreamland. I hope it has been a rich, satisfying Dreamland experience for all of you. I know it has for me, and it was for Joseph Farrell. I thank you for being listeners to Dreamland and for taking it at least this far in your own life.